Okay, thank you. So, well, as David mentioned, some of the most exciting ideas in condensed matter physics right now somehow are all about trying to create particles whose statistics is neither bosonic nor fermionic. Now, not every condensed matter physicist would agree with me, but I would imagine that many of the people who are participants of our program probably do agree that such an opportunity of creating such particles is quite exciting. So many people worked on trying to understand how you could possibly to create such particles. And many models were invented. Some of them are very sophisticated on how to try to create these particles. And I'm not going to talk about all these models, but I'd like to talk about just one particular proposal for realizing these particles, which in my opinion is some of the most natural ways of realizing particles with non-abelian statistics. Although here I'm biased because that's probably the only model with non-abelian statistics to which I've contributed. At the same time, I didn't contribute to any of the other models. So you have to take it with a grain of salt, but at least I can explain, I think, relatively simply how this model works. And so the idea of this model is based on the fact that actually it's possible to create particles with non-abelian statistics using superconductivity. And so what I'd like to try to do is to explain the connection between non-abelian statistics, superconductivity, and cold atoms. So actually my talk will consist of three parts, which I'll try to connect together. So the first part is non-abelian statistics. The second part is superconductivity and non-abelian statistics. And the third part would be cold atoms, superconductivity, and non-abelian statistics together. So let's begin with non-abelian statistics. So we all know that all particles in this world are either bosons or fermions, and well, the reason they are is because when we have two particles and we exchange them, their wave functions has to either stay the same or get multiplied by minus one. And I'm talking about identical particles. Now, why is it that the wave function has to either stay the same or get multiplied by minus one? Well, that's because if we exchange two particles twice, the wave function should go back to where we started, should get multiplied by one. So if we interchange them only once, the wave function should get multiplied by either minus one or one. But then the next question is, why is that when we exchange two particles twice, the wave function gets multiplied, doesn't get changed? Well, the reason for that is you can think of exchanging two particles twice as taking one particle and taking it around a loop around the other particle. That's equivalent to exchanging particles twice. And now taking one particle in a big loop around another particle is a procedure which is not well defined in the sense that I can deform this loop and make it smaller and smaller, lift it up a little bit, and then shrink it down to zero. That this procedure is pretty much indistinguishable from this procedure, and in this procedure I'm almost not moving this particle at all. So taking one particle around the loop around the other should be equivalent to taking one particle and moving it around some tiny loop which is not going around the other particle. In other words, this procedure should not change the wave function. And that's why exchanging particle twice does not change the wave function. But it has been observed for a long time that this argument breaks down in two dimensions. If we're in two dimensions, then taking one particle around another in a closed loop is actually a well-defined procedure. In two dimensions, this loop cannot be shrunk to a point because it'll always be, well, you'll have to drag it through the point where the other particle resides. So you can actually give a meaning of exchanging two particles twice in two dimensions, going beyond just saying that the wave function doesn't change. So in general, in two dimensions, as a result, exchanging two particles may not leave the wave function invariant. It may multiply it by a phase. So here dots represent all other particles which are not moving. So I've exchanged two particles and the wave function is getting multiplied by a phase. So such hypothetical particles which live in two dimensions and whose wave function gets multiplied by a phase when I exchange them are called anions, or sometimes they are called particles which obey fractional statistics. Now we can go even further. We don't have to say that the wave function has to get multiplied by a phase. We can imagine a system of particles whose wave function is not just one scalar wave function, but it's the whole vector. It's a wave function which is controlled by some index. I'll call it alpha. And so two particles being in a position x1 and x2 are described by a vector wave function. And when I exchange these two wave functions, when I exchange these two particles, the wave function gets multiplied by a matrix, not just by a phase, but by the whole matrix, which has to be unitary to preserve probabilities. So the result of exchange of two particles is the sum over beta of x2, x1, and so on. And so such hypothetical particles in two dimensions receive the name of particles with non-abelian statistics. The reason their statistics is called non-abelian is because the result of exchanging these particles depends on the order at which I am exchanging them. So I can imagine exchanging particle 1 and 2, and that multiplies the wave function by a unitary matrix. Then particle 2 and 3, that multiplies the wave function by another unitary matrix. Or I can do it in the opposite order, and then that multiplies wave function by the same matrices, but in the other order. Since matrices in general do not commute, these processes of exchanging particles do not commute. And that's why such particles are called particles with non-abelian statistics. So all, of course, this is all very nice, but this only exists in two dimensions. And so the next question which arises is whether these particles can possibly exist in nature, because our world is not two-dimensional. So barring some developments in high-energy physics where they'll tell us that actually there are such particles, you just have to look for them, maybe at very high energies, one suggestion which came about quite a while ago was, why wouldn't we try to look for some such particles, not among elementary particles of nature, but rather in collective excitations of some many-body systems, which can be confined to two dimensions in a real experiment. And in fact, this program of looking for these particles under these conditions essentially was fulfilled in the context of quantum Hall effect. So quantum Hall effect is the case where I think nobody doubts that it has particles with fractional and even particles with non-abelian statistics. I would say non-abelian statistics are a little bit more arguable compared to fractional statistics, but definitely with fractional statistics, I don't think there are people who would disagree with this. And so in order to make my talk complete, I really need to talk about quantum Hall effect, since this is the only system which exists in nature where these particles exist. Now, I wouldn't be able to talk in great detail about quantum Hall effect, so let me just give you a general idea. So quantum Hall effect is observed when electrons in semiconductor heterostructures are confined to move strictly in a two-dimensional plane, in a strong magnetic field which is perpendicular to this plane. And under these conditions, electrons form some sort of a liquid with a density which is more or less constant. If you try to excite such liquids, if you try to create excitations in this liquid, somehow the way the liquid responds is by expanding a little bit and by creating small areas with deficiency of electron density. And those areas, they are called Laughlin quasar holes, after Laughlin, who first explained what these things are. They are objects which nobody doubts have fractional statistics. If you take one of them around the other one, the wave function of the whole system, which contains all these electrons, will generate a phase which will not be 1 or minus 1. It's going to be a more general phase. Actually, depending on the strength of the magnetic field in a experiment, you can get all sorts of variety of different phases. And moreover, I think people more or less agree that there are some values of magnetic field at which you can even get particles with non-abelian statistics, where this U alpha beta is a matrix as opposed to just a phase. Now, whether whether everybody agrees that these particles have fractional statistics or not depends perhaps on your point of view. The thing is that nobody has observed experimentally that these particles in the quantum Hall effect have fractional statistics. What people do, I think, agree with, that these particles somehow have fractional charge. In the simplest of all the quantum Hall effects, this depletion in electron density, which is a Laughlin quasar hole, carries a charge which is exactly one third of the electron charge. Now, the fact that there is such a excitation, such a composite particle in quantum Hall effect, which is a charge, which is a fraction of electron charge, I would say everybody, even the hardest experimentalists, probably agree with this. And as a proof, I just wanted to read the citation for the Nobel Prize given to Laughlin, Stormer, and Tsui in 1998. The citation says, "For the discovery of a new form of quantum fluid with fractionally charged excitations." So since, as far as I understand, Nobel Committee likes to give Nobel Prizes only for things which actually do exist in nature, that means that these fractionally charged particles do exist. There's no doubt about it. And actually, there were some experiments in the 90s, although I'm not exactly sure whether everybody agrees with these experiments, where this fractional charge was directly measured. But there were other experiments where people tried to measure the fractional statistics of these particles, and actually, so far, nobody was able to do it, neither fractional nor non-Abelian statistics.
I mean, the statistics are consistent with the phase changing by minus 1 or 1, or is it hard to measure?
It's hard to measure the phase change. It's not consistent with phase change by plus 1 or minus 1. It's just a very difficult experiment, which nobody was able so far to do. But on the other hand, numerically, these systems were studied to the death, and I think people who did numerics all agree that these excitations are not only fractionally charged, they also have fractional statistics. So because quantum Hall effect led to such difficulty in observing these particles, although nobody doubts that they exist, there is now an effort to try to maybe create other systems where these particles can be measured, perhaps with more ease. And of course, this definition of more ease is not really obvious to everybody. I mean, quantum Hall effect is a well-studied system, and still people are unable to observe the fractional and non-Abelian statistics for reasons which appear to be technical, not fundamental, just hard to do experiments on this system. It's too fragile. So the idea is to try to come with a system which is more robust and which also has this kind of particles. Now, by the way, the reason why recently this whole quest for finding particles with non-Abelian statistics, it has been given some kind of additional momentum is because there has been proposals beginning from maybe late 90s to use such particles to build quantum computers. Now, quantum computers are these proposed quantum mechanical devices which consist of a bunch of spins to which you can apply unitary transformations. And people have been trying to realize quantum computers by actually taking real spins attached to atoms, putting them in some kind of cavity, and applying unitary transformations to them. But the problem is that these spins all interact, and they interact with the outside world, and every time somebody runs by your lab, those spins get multiplied by all sorts of random unitary matrices, so it's very hard to control what these spins are doing. Well, at the idea of quantum computer, we know exactly which unitary matrix we would apply to a given spin. But now particles with non-Abelian statistics somehow give us a natural avenue on how to apply controlled unitary matrices. It is the nature of these particles. When two of them are exchanged, their wave function gets multiplied by a specific unitary matrix. Does not depend on anything. Does not depend on noise, on what happens in the rest of the universe. This matrix is given once and for all. So if you could create particles with non-Abelian statistics, you could possibly, essentially, right away build a quantum computer, which is a noble goal, I would say. So that's why people do think about how to create such particles. And so there's a quest in trying to realize other models in nature, other than quantum Hall effect, where particles with non-Abelian statistics could be observed. Now, in a search for such model, we should ask ourselves, what was so special about quantum Hall effect which made these particles exist and have fractional or even non-Abelian statistics? Well, one of the things is, of course, it's two-dimensional, so we need to have some kind of a system which is going to be two-dimensional. But there is more than that. One of the important quantities or qualities of quantum Hall effect which ensured that these particles with fractional and non-Abelian statistics exist is that these particles themselves, being some kind of excitation of your many-body system, are protected by a gap from other excitations. Which means to add more excitation to the system, you need to spend finite amount of energy. There's an energy gap between the energy level representing one particle and, say, energy level representing two particles, and so on. So in particular, what it means is that if we have two such particles, such as Laughlin particles, and drag one of them around another, if we do it sufficiently slowly, we will not create all sorts of high-energy excitations consisting of just electrons flying around randomly. We would say that we have to give a finite amount of energy to a Laughlin particle to break it into pieces. Or I don't know, maybe glue it back to an electron actually, because it's a fraction of an electron. This existence of a gap between the energy level representing Laughlin particle and other higher, more energetic energy level levels in the system is very important. That's what protects the fractional non-abelian statistics from becoming just the usual statistics. So we really need to look for a system which has particles with fractional statistics, and then it has gap with respect to other more energetic excitations. The system should not have continuous spectrum. So that's one of the conditions which a system has to satisfy in order to have particles with fractional statistics, existence of a gap protecting these particles, or energy gap in the spectrum of the system. Now, there is another condition which turns out to be crucial. As I said before, Laughlin quasi-particle is actually fractionally charged. It's charged with a charge which is a third of the charge of the electron. And so somehow that's also very crucial in protecting the statistics. As Kitaev emphasized, if Laughlin particle was a full electron, just some kind of dressed electron, so that has fractional statistics, then we would imagine that some noise, you know, cosmic radiation or somebody kicking the apparatus and the phonon interacting with this electron, some noise could affect the phase of this electron and scramble it. And then it will no longer have fractional statistics. But in the Laughlin case, somehow electron effectively broke down into three pieces, each of them being the Laughlin quasi-hole, and each of them sitting in a separate place in space, which means that noise, which can talk only to an electron, would have to somehow coherently talk simultaneously to three Laughlin quasi-particles in exactly the same way in order to scramble their phase, because the electron is effectively broken into pieces, spends maybe a third of its time in each of these Laughlin quasi-particles. But the noise typically is uncorrelated in space. So if you take Laughlin quasi-particles far apart, no noise will be able to scramble their phase. And that's what we want. We want them to have a specific fractional phase. So this property of fractionalization, quite exotic property, but for which the Nobel Prize was given, is also a very important one. We need to have fractionalization. And of course, the third condition is 2D. So if we're in 2D, we have energy gap and we have fractionalization, we should hope to achieve particles, observe perhaps particles with a fraction of non-abelian statistics. So many models were suggested, as I said, which have this property. Some of them are very sophisticated. But today I want to go back to basics, and I want to discuss the theory of superconductivity, so also called Bardeen-Cooper-Schiffer theory, which actually has in itself at least fractionalization. It naturally wants to break an electron into two pieces. This, by the way, was not what Bardeen-Cooper and Schiffer had in mind when they invented their theory. And by the way, this year is the 50th anniversary of the Bardeen-Cooper-Schiffer theory, so maybe it's just fitting that I'll spend a substantial part of my talk today talking about superconductors. So all they cared about was superconductivity. The fact that if they take a metal, cool it down to a very low temperature, and the electrons in this metal form a superfluid, they can flow without resistance, and they wanted to create a theory which explains this. So fractionalization of an electron is an unintentional byproduct of this theory, and it has only been emphasized, I would say, from the 80s or late 80s. So this is what happens in a superconductor. I also want to add, to avoid any kind of confusion, that the word superconductor, in the way how I'm going to be using it today, is somewhat a misnomer. Superconductivity is a theory of superfluidity of electrons. But you can have other fermions which are superfluid. For example, helium-3 consists of fermionic atoms, the isotope of helium which are fermions. It's known to be superfluid at very low temperatures. And Bardeen-Cooper-Schiffer theory actually explains the superfluidity of helium-3. But it's by no means a superconductor, because these atoms are neutral. So supercurrent in such a superfluid does not carry any current. Superflow does not carry any current. So it would be more correct to say not superconductivity for my purposes, but fermionic superfluidity. But to say fermionic superfluidity takes two words, and superconductivity is one word. And also, but then you don't have one word for it. You have to come up with it to make life easier. But also, usually people do say Bardeen-Cooper-Schiffer theory of superconductivity. Nobody says Bardeen-Cooper theory of fermionic superfluidity. It just doesn't, it's not natural to say these words. So I'll be using the word superconductivity, having in mind superfluid states of a large number of fermions. So my aim right now is to switch to the next, second part of my talk and tell you about why superconductors want to break a fermion into two pieces. And so for that, I will need to recall a little bit some aspects of Bardeen-Cooper theory, Bardeen-Cooper-Schiffer theory of superconductivity. So let's start with a gas of fermions. And to describe it, I will need creation annihilation operators. So AI will be my annihilation, and AI dagger, creation operators of some fermions, where I stands for some kind of collective coordinate. I mean, it could be spin, it could be coordinate in space. I could have called it X and the spin index, but for simplicity, I want to call it I. So let me write this. I is a coordinate, and spin. Everything together is lumped in one AI. So a Hamiltonian of such a system of fermions usually can be written as expression which is bilinear in creation and annihilation operators. And typically I can write it as a sum over ij. Well, it will become an integral if I go to the continuous coordinates of some Hamiltonian, hij, ai dagger, aj. Actually, I'll put two in front for a later convenience, although these two can be absorbed into h. Now, these are very formal, very abstract notations, but which will be convenient for me to use. What I really mean for, by h is, of course, a Schrodinger operator. That's like minus 1 over 2m times Laplacian plus some potential. And these ij are spatial indexes on which this operator acts. But it's easier for me to write matrices, so I'm going to write matrices. So this is the Hamiltonian of a free Fermi gas. Now, the insight of Bardeen-Cooper and Schiffer was that in the presence of attractive interactions, these guys want to form pairs. And those pairs are described by a pair function, delta ij. And so the full Hamiltonian can be written in the way how I wrote it on the blackboard. So here, delta ij is a pair function describing how fermions form Cooper pairs, which then form this superconductor. So for later...
You don't want a dagger
on where? That's true. You're absolutely right, yes. I wrote complex conjugate, a Hermitian conjugate of the first term. So let me actually write it in a slightly different way. By subtracting from this Hamiltonian an unnecessary or unimportant constant, I can write it as hij ai dagger aj minus aj ai dagger plus delta ij ai dagger aj dagger plus delta ij star aj ai. So what I did here is I used the fact that fermionic operators anti-commute, and I wrote it in a slightly more symmetric fashion, like this. This generated a constant. Every time I exchange A and A dagger, I could get 1. If A and A dagger were the same index, get exchanged. But this is not important to me. It's just some constant which gives me the energy scale from which I count my ground state. So now this Hamiltonian can be written in a very compact notation, matrix notation, where I put AI dagger AI here. And I'll put here hij delta ij my delta dagger ij, where delta is now understood as a matrix, and this is its Hermitian conjugate. And finally, transpose of hij ai aj aj dagger. So it's very easy to see that if I multiply through these guys and sum over I and j, I reproduce what's written in here. So the reason why this is such a nice form is because it's very easy to see what my problem is. It's this guy which is here, which is a matrix describing the Hamiltonian of a superconductor. So in other words, a Hamiltonian is a superconductor whose I mean, superconductor is described by a Hamiltonian which has a structure, the one which is written here on this blackboard. So let me call this matrix H. And let me know that this matrix definitely is not arbitrary, has to have something here, minus something transpose here, has to have these guys here and there. And it's possible to show that this property, that it has a structure, can be expressed by simple relationship. I'll introduce a matrix sigma 1, and it's very easy to see that if I conjugate H with sigma 1, and sigma 1, of course, is a Pauli matrix, 0, 1, 1, 0. If I conjugate H with sigma 1, so I have to take this guy, multiply by sigma 1 on the left and on the right, I'll get minus H complex conjugate. This is very important. This is the symmetry property of any BCS Hamiltonian. In fact, I could have just declared that the Hamiltonian has this property, and that's equivalent to writing it in this form. This guy here minus this guy there, and so on. So this is a concise way of saying that my theory is a superconductor and not something else. Well, Martin Cooper Schrieffer's theory of superconductor. Now, what do I do with this problem? Well, in quantum mechanics, we like to diagonalize Hamiltonians. So the idea is that we need to diagonalize this matrix. To diagonalize it, we need to write down an equation for its eigenvalues, which looks like this. H psi is equal to E psi m, E psi m. Now, that's a pretty obvious equation. Now, here I'm using matrix notations. This is a matrix. These guys are vectors. Now, these equations, for various historical reasons in the theory of superconductivity, are called Bogoliubov-Dejean equations. Although, in the end of the day, they're just equations for an eigenstate of a given matrix. So let me write this here. They are Bogoliubov-Dejean equations. That's somehow how everybody talks about them. And as a consequence of this special symmetry property of our Hamiltonian, the equations also have a special symmetry property. Namely, if psi n is an eigenstate of my Hamiltonian, then sigma 1 psi n dagger is also an eigenstate of my Hamiltonian. With an eigenvalue which is exactly minus en. So that can be checked very simply by multiplying this guy by sigma 1 square on the left, and then observing, and sigma 1 square of course is 1, that's sigma 1, the square is 1. So then we observe that sigma 1 h sigma 1 is minus h star, so we get minus sigma 1 h star psi n star, and now this guy is of course en psi n star because h is Hermitian, so we get minus en sigma 1 psi n star, and that concludes the proof. So for each energy level en, we have an energy level minus en. So if psi is thought of as a vector u and vn in the space of these a's and a daggers, then sigma 1 psi n star is vn star un star. That's pretty easy to see. So this guy is the eigenvalue, eigenvector with an eigenvalue n. This guy is the eigenvector with the opposite eigenvalue. And so once we know eigenvectors and eigenvalues, it's very easy to solve the problem. We have to introduce rotated creation annihilation operators, which are called creation operators for Bogoliubov quasi-particles. And here, I don't want to make any errors, so I'm going to write how they express in terms of u and v. It's very easy to confuse daggers and non-daggers. So that would be the creation operator, and this complex conjugate is annihilation operator for Bogoliubov particles. And in terms of these guys, the original Hamiltonian can be written as sum over n, en, gamma n dagger, gamma n, minus gamma n dagger. The reason we have this minus that is because eigenvalues came in pairs, en and minus en. So now, once we have this Hamiltonian, it's very easy to see what the ground state is. The ground state is annihilated by all annihilation operators. The ground state is called BCS ground state. And then acting by creation operators on the ground state creates Bogoliubov quasi-particles. So these are quasi-particles which move around in superconductor with energy en. So far it's all very standard. But now I'll introduce one more part to the picture. What happens if this equation written here has zero energy solutions, which I'll call zero modes? So suppose there is a state psi such that h psi is equal to zero. Well, then, according to what I just said, h sigma 1 psi star is also equal to zero, because the other one should also be an eigenvalue with, eigenvector with the same eigenvalue. And then I could easily see that if I take a linear combination psi plus sigma 1 psi star and call it psi naught, or alternatively I could actually use psi minus sigma 1 psi star times I, doesn't matter, I could use either of the two. And then psi naught, of course, is a zero mode, h psi naught is equal to zero. But on top of it, it satisfies the relationship sigma 1 psi naught star is equal to psi naught. So then it follows from here that every zero mode of a superconductor can be written in this form. Sigma 1 times the zero mode is a complex conjugate. Gives me back that zero mode. So if I think of this in terms of U and V, it means that a zero mode has to have a form U naught star. That's because this has to be equal to that. So Vn star has to be equal to Un. Is this correct? Okay. So, given the zero mode, I can construct Bogoliubov creation iterator. So I substitute what I have here, and I have it's equal to sum over I, U zero I, A I dagger, plus U complex conjugate I, A I. So that would be the creation iterator of the zero mode. But quite amazingly, by inspection of this guy, I observe that this is equal to gamma. If I complex conjugate it, I get back what I started with. So gamma cannot be a creation iterator of a fermion because its complex conjugate is not equal, well, it's literally equal to itself. In fact, gamma represents half of a fermion. So every zero mode in a superconductor happens to be half of a fermion. In order to assemble back my fermion, I need to have two zero modes. Once I have two zero modes, and let me call them gamma 1 and gamma 2, then I can create out of them a fermion by writing C creation operator or annihilation operator of a fermion being gamma 1 plus I gamma 2, and C dagger being gamma 1 minus I gamma 2. And then C dagger will actually be fermionic creation annihilation operators. So their anti-commutator, for example, it can be easily checked, is equal to 1, and that's because gamma anti-commutes with other gammas, and also you can check that gamma square is equal to 1. Take this gamma, take a square, use the fact that A and A dagger anti-commutes, and also that U represents a normalized eigenstates of a matrix, and that follows from this in just a couple of lines.
You show that they're always coming pairs?
The reason they always come in pairs is actually kind of almost obvious. If you look at this matrix I started with, it definitely has even dimension. It's an even dimensional matrix. And all non-zero eigenvalues come in pairs. So all zero eigenvalues should also come in pairs. So there's always an even number of zero eigenvalues. You can always assemble them together into fermions. But with one thing, it may so happen that one of these U's, this U01, let's call it, which represents gamma 1, as a function of I, as a function of its coordinate, can be localized in one place in space. And the other part of a fermion can be localized in some other place in space. And then what happens is that effectively your original fermion broke into two halves, and one of them sits here and the other sits over there. So we get fractionalization. Zero modes in a superconductor, assuming that they can be split the way I described. One zero mode sits in one place and another one sits somewhere far away, they automatically break an electron into two halves. So having a superconductor in two dimensions would then be exciting because we get at least one of the conditions for fractional statistics. We get fractionalization.
You haven't told us yet how the nature of the interaction, which is the driver of all this, determines or figures into the choice of the statistics.
I haven't. Actually, the choice of the statistics is controlled by what delta is and what h is. But and I'm about to talk about it. In turn, h and delta is determined by whatever was the nature of interactions of your original fermionic system. So I'm going to talk about it right now.
Just to make sure I remember right, quantum Hall effect is just the Coulomb interaction of the electron.
Yes.
Whereas BCS is phonon mediated.
Not necessarily. So in BCS, you can have any kind of attraction between fermions, and a superconductor will form, described by this Hamiltonian. Can be phonon mediated, could be direct attraction.
No, I understand, but in terms of the reality of superconductors, it is phonon.
Conventional superconductors, the ones which we might create with cold atoms, this will be some kind of van der Waals attraction that will not be phonon mediated. But I'll come to that a little bit later. So let's see. We see now that if we have zero modes in a superconductor, they represent half of a fermion. So they provide fractionalization for us at almost no cost. Comes out of BCS theory in just a few lines. But now we need to check for the second condition, which is gap. And here we run into trouble right away. So first of all, conventional superconductors, the ones which electrons form when they're cooled down to when metals are cooled down to very low temperatures, they're called S-wave superconductors, and they are known to have a gap, which means they have no zero energy solutions to the Bogoliubov-Bezhany equation. All solutions to this equation are such that En is at least bigger than some value, or smaller than negative of that value, since solutions come in pairs. So conventional superconductors all have a gap, and there's no states in there. In particular, there's no zero modes. That's why if you take a mercury, for example, like Kamerling-Onnes did, and cool it down, you will not get fractionalization. We need to find a superconductor which would support zero modes. Now, for that, we need to do something with the gap, it would seem, because the gap is there and protects all solutions with energy smaller than certain energy. Now, in fact, it's known in condensed matter physics that there are gapless superconductors. There are many ways to get them. But typically, those guys, they don't have a gap at all, which means they have zero mode, and they also have all sorts of other modes sitting right on top of the zero modes. So you can have zero modes, and they will break your fermion into pieces, but then they will not be protected by any gap. You will not get fractional statistics. We need to look for a superconductor which would have a zero mode, then a gap, and then the rest of the stuff. And it turns out that such a situation is provided by so-called P-wave superconductors. The P-wave superconductors are the ones which would form if, for example, you have spinless fermions. Now, when I say spinless, of course, I don't mean that you can somehow separate a fermion from its spin, but all fermions have spin. But you can apply a magnetic field, for example, polarize all the spins. Then effectively, fermions behave as if they're spinless. So if the fermions are spinless, then one way they can pair is through forming a Cooper pair with angular momentum. That's because otherwise, as the fermions form a pair, the fermionic statistics cannot be enforced unless the angular momentum is odd. So the simplest angular momentum is P-wave. So what it means on the language of this Hamiltonian is that we choose for Hij just a usual Hamiltonian for free particles, that's the kinetic energy minus chemical potential. And for delta ij, we need to choose something which is short range in space and yet preserve fermionic statistics. By the way, here it's easy to see that fermionic statistics implies that this guy is anti-commute, which means that this delta is anti-symmetric. That was, by the way, important to show that this is correct. Delta anti-symmetric is part of this relation. So we need to come up with a delta which is short-range and anti-symmetric, and the only such operator, or the simplest such operator, is the derivative. It's anti-symmetric, it transposes minus itself. So delta ij should be replaced by some kind of vector, delta mu times I d dx mu, which is the same as p mu delta mu. But delta mu is some kind of vector. And under these conditions, well, the system I'm describing here is called P-wave superconductor. Now, delta mu is some kind of vector, and there are several possibilities for it. One of them is that it's a real vector. If it's a real vector, we can always rotate our reference frame so that delta mu points along a certain direction. And so delta mu could be chosen to be, let's say, 1, 0 times some coefficient delta. Second case is it's a complex vector, and then it can generally be chosen to be delta times a vector which looks like 1 and I. And this is called PX superconductor. This code is called PX plus IPY superconductor. And the reason for that is very simple. If I now take this delta, plug it into here, and diagonalize the matrix I'll get is going to be P squared over 2 M minus mu, and I have here delta mu P mu, delta mu P mu minus P squared over 2 M plus mu. So I just substitute these operators in here and work out what it means to put here Hermitian conjugate and transpose. And now this guy can be diagonalized very easily, and I get the spectrum, which is momentum dependent, which looks like this. P squared over 2m minus mu squared plus delta mu delta mu star P mu P mu. So if you worked what this is in these two cases, you will see that in the first case, it means that I have something like P squared over 2m minus mu squared plus px squared delta squared, where x is the direction of the first component of this delta. While here, in the second case, I'm going to get that this is square root of p squared over 2m minus mu squared plus delta square, and here I have px squared plus py squared.
Can I ask a question? How you went from there to there? I presume in ij you have identity in all the indices and just everything is multiplying with p squared over 2m minus mu. But what about the second?
Well, this is a matrix. So in ij stands for space, for coordinates. So I went to the continuous notations from matrix notations. I replaced the matrix by an operator. Well, if I were on the actual lattice, I could have kept the discrete, and I could have said that this is a lattice Laplacian. But these matrix notations were just for me to come up with this argument and not having to put all sorts of scary operator notations. But in the end of the day, in quantum mechanics, we have to work with operators when we're in continuous space. And so this guy gets replaced by an operator. So these are the spectra of the PX superconductor and PX plus IPY superconductor. And it's pretty clear from what I wrote here the reason why they're called like this. This guy has px squared plus py squared, x and y are my coordinates. This guy only has px squared. So now let's look at this spectra. If mu is negative, then both of them have a gap, meaning as you, no matter what p you choose, ep never becomes zero if mu is negative. If mu is positive, on the other hand, this one doesn't have a gap, and this one does. So this one doesn't have a gap because for positive mu, I can choose p in such a way that p squared over 2m is exactly equal to mu, and at the same time, py is 0, so p is in the x direction. Actually, the other way around, px is 0, and p is in the y direction, to nullify this term also, and then this guy doesn't have a gap. So we see that there are at least three regimes where there is a gap, so there is some hope that we are going in the right direction. I'll put here a little table. I don't know how well it can be seen, but I'll put here mu greater than 0, mu less than 0, px, px plus ipy. I'll say for mu greater than 0, this guy has a gap, and this guy doesn't have a gap. And now mu less than 0, both of them have gaps. But notice that the guys which have gap, they also don't have any zero energy states. So where am I with respect to creating zero energy states protected by a gap? So it turns out, and it was only understood, I would think, in the late 80s, maybe in the 90s, beginning perhaps from the work of Valavik, that if you create vortices in the order parameter of this superconductor, and actually it has to be px plus ipy, and it has to be with positive chemical potential, then you start creating zero modes. So what it means is the following. If you take delta mu to be e to the I phi, 1i, where there is a point in space somewhere at the position r, where there's a vortex, and then I introduce an angular coordinate as I go around the vortex, and this is this phi, which sits here. So if delta mu is this, and if I take this delta mu, stick it in here, stick it in there, I'll discover that there is a zero mode, exactly one, which is centered around this vortex and is exponentially localized around this vortex, which means the function u of x, roughly speaking, looks like minus, let me call it u of r, u at some point r, and let me call it r1. R1 is the position of the vortex. It's r minus r1 divided by some length, which is actually, I think, mass times this delta which sits in here. But it's not very important. So for a vortex sitting at this position, the wave function of the vortex, well, of the zero mode, is exponentially localized around it. Now, if I have one such vortex, I only have one zero mode. Somewhere there has to be a second zero mode. Let's imagine for a second that very far away there's another zero mode, which is here, and there's another zero mode, well, and the other parameter also changes by 2 pi as I go around this point, in addition to going around this point. Then one can check that there exists a second zero mode, which is exponentially localized around this point. So this would be the first zero mode, but in principle, let me write, put it ri here. So there are zero modes at positions r1, r2, r3, and so on. Each of them are controlled by these guys. And now, and they correspond to creation operators, which look like, I'm abusing notations. It's because now it's a function of r. It becomes an integral over dr of ui of r, and then annihilation operator, a creation operator at the point r plus ui complex conjugate of r, creation operator of r. So there are these guys, these zero modes, and they're not fermions. They're half of fermions each. I have to combine them together to create a full fermion. So a full fermion somehow sits at two vortices simultaneously, which is hard to imagine, but this is presumably what happens in a p-wave superconductor with the right symmetry of the other parameter. So these guys are zero modes, and all other modes are separated from the zero mode by a gap. Therefore, all these conditions are fulfilled in 2D, fractionalization, and gap. All three conditions are at work. Any questions? Okay. No, not necessarily. It's just too different. Just like this, I already erased it here, but we have different Bogoliubov excitations corresponding to different eigenvectors of this equation. The definition gamma n was written there before. So now I have two separate zero modes of my Bogoliubov-Dejean equation, and each of them corresponds to its own Bogoliubov particle. So I have two independent gamma particles. Now you're saying that let's take a product of gamma 1, gamma 2. Well, but that doesn't create anything because the square of it is minus 1. I need to construct the creation annihilation operator, and these guys are creation annihilation operators. So if I write C dagger here, I can check that this indeed satisfies all the conditions for creation annihilation operator. So therefore, it follows from here that once we create p-wave superconductor, we fulfill all these conditions. And so the last remaining question is whether we actually have fractional non-abelian statistics. And that question was answered by Dmitry Ivanov in his PRL, which he wrote in the year 2000, but it was published only a year later. So I don't know the story behind it, but probably it took a while for the editors to accept it, although I would imagine that this is a very influential paper in this field. So what he demonstrated, you know, using a very clever technique, that if you take one such vortex and take it around another vortex, the wave function gets multiplied by a phase. And actually, it's almost obvious in some sense. Imagine that I'm taking this vortex around another vortex. Effectively, this guy feels that as it goes around the other guy, the phase is changing, and it's going all the way around 2 pi as one of them goes around the other. And as delta goes around 2 pi, A has to go around pi. So what can be checked is that these gammas exactly change sign as one vortex is taken around the other vortex. But that's not fermion or bosonic statistics. When a fermion is taken around and around another fermion and is taken all the way back, like explained here, the wave function should come back to what it was. Here it doesn't. And actually, it's even possible to show that there is even non-abelian statistics here, not only fractional. Imagine we have four vortices, and they're in four positions in space. And these two vortices correspond to one fermion, and these two vortices correspond to another fermion, because we need to have two vortices to have one fermion. So if you take this guy around the other guy, you can check that these fermions go into some non-trivial linear combination of these two fermions. And that combination was computed by Ivanov. There's an explicit expression in his paper, which is not hard to reproduce, but I wouldn't have time to do it right now. And therefore, these particles have no Abelian statistics. So all you need to do is to create p-wave superconductor, create vortices, and start dragging them around each other. And then you're done. So, well, that's a great program. Now the question is, where do we get p-wave superconductors? There's one p-wave superconductor well known. It's helium-3. So in principle, if you make a thin film of helium-3, you could imagine creating particles with non-Abelian statistics. The question is how you're going to measure it. Helium-3 doesn't conduct, it's only superfluid. What do you do with helium-3 to see that there is a non-Abelian particle sitting in there? That's not really clear. Well, then it turns out there are some conventional superconductor, electrical superconductor, which actually superconduct, which might be two-dimensional p-wave. There's one material called strontium ruthenite, which is a strong candidate for being a p-wave two-dimensional superconductor. And right now there are experiments where people are trying to see whether indeed it's p-wave or not. And if it is, maybe they will make particles with non-Abelian statistics.
I feel like I lost a step. So with the p-wave, it's a helium-3. Do you not think, I mean, it's a 3D superfluid.
So you have to create thin film. 2D. You create thin film of helium-3. Yeah, I said that, but too quickly.
In
2D.
In a 2D.
You would create vortices by rotating helium-3.
Would you have vortices?
Yes, then there will be...
It would appear to be 2D, even if it's 3D. That's what I'm saying.
So what is important is, if you have 3D vortex, then the zero mode turns into the whole band with the momentum directed along the vortex. So you want to compress it enough to, you know, push up the first excited state of that band and protect the zero mode, and that zero mode will become what I want. And as far as I understand, it's possible to create thin films of helium-3, which would do this, although I didn't look into details. But my understanding is that, and then the question is, and then what? What will happen afterwards?
But p-wave is not sufficient. You want p plus ip.
Yes, and that is known. So it's known that if you take helium-3 and apply high magnetic field to polarize spins of helium-3 atoms, you'll go into the so-called A1 phase of helium-3, which happens to formally coincide with spinless px plus ipy superconductor. So here, there is no doubt that it's achievable in helium-3, but, the question is what to do next. So then I was talking about strontium ruthenite, which could be a p-wave superconductor. This is still a controversial subject, or I would say even a subject under development. My understanding that we'll have a talk in our program regarding the latest status of strontium ruthenite and whether it's a p-wave superconductor or not. So I'm not going to talk about these efforts either, but I will mention the efforts in which I participated, namely trying to do the same with cold atoms. So what do I mean by trying to do this with cold atoms? So in the cold atom field, a progress has been achieved with creating a gas of fermionic atoms. They are usually alkali atoms, which are cooled down to very low temperatures, and they're set in some kind of a magnetic or optical trap and interact with each other. And moreover, their interactions can be almost hand-engineered. In particular, you can turn on some attractive interactions between these atoms, and you could make them arbitrarily weak or arbitrarily strong. Although I would say arbitrarily weak is a slight exaggeration, but definitely arbitrarily strong. So the study of such gases became part of the branch of our field called BCS-BEC crossover, which involves taking a gas of these fermionic atoms, cooling them down, turning on attractive interactions. And so these are atoms which fly around, and then as you increase the strength of interaction, so at first, as they're weakly attractive, they form a superconductor with weakly correlated Cooper pairs. But as you increase the strength of interactions, they form diatomic molecules. Obviously, when interactions are very strong, a molecule will form. Now, these guys are bosons, so they both condense. And the whole field is called BCS-BEC crossover because you go from the BCS state of weakly attractive atoms to a BEC, Bose-Einstein condensate, of bosons, which are these diatomic molecules. So as you go through the crossover, a number of things happen. First of all, it's interesting what happens with chemical potential. So chemical potential on the BCS side is roughly equal to some value. I'll call it Fermi energy, as if these guys are not interacting. And it's well known that small attractive interactions almost do not do anything to chemical potential. But as you increase the strength of interaction, what happens is that at some point these molecules form, and now the molecules are bosons with some binding energy. Now it's well known that a gas of bosons, which sits at low temperature, wants to have chemical potential which is equal to its rest energy. That's the first thing which follows from Bose-Einstein condensation. So here, chemical potential should be equal to the rest energy of this boson, which is nothing but the binding energy, some negative binding energy. So as you increase the strength of interaction, chemical potential starts going through zero and eventually becomes negative to follow the binding energy of these molecules. And then second interesting object is the critical temperature at which this guy is no longer a superconductor. So again, if I plot here interaction, at weak interactions, it's very small, and it's given by the BCS formula, which predicts that it's exponentially small in the strength of interactions. And as you increase interactions, it saturates at some value, which is the Bose-Einstein condensation temperature of these molecules. So as you increase interaction strength, it's harder and harder to destroy such condensate. You have to go to higher and higher temperatures. So this is roughly what people study in the BCS-BEC crossover. They can actually realize it in the experiment, and they can study this curve, which I've drawn here. What we propose to do is to look at the P-wave BCS-BEC crossover. Normally, these guys have atoms which are fermions, so they have spin 1/2, and they form S-wave superconductor, where the spins combine together in the S-wave. Well, each pair has total spin 0, so that in a coordinate space, delta ij is actually a symmetric matrix, which means it doesn't have any derivatives, just a constant. If you stick it a constant here, you'll get a gap with no zero modes. So the usual S-wave superconductor doesn't have zero modes. But what you could do is, in this atomic problem, you can prepare your odd atoms in the exactly identical spin state. That's possible to do. And they all have identical spin, they're identical fermions. You can then cool them down and hope that they'll form a P-wave superconductor. Then the next question is, what kind of superconductor they'll form? Will they form this guy, or will they form this guy? If they form this guy, then we're in trouble. But this guy, then we're in business. Well, so turns out that there was a work by Anderson and Morel in 1961, and they showed that a P-wave superconductor, or in other words, a bunch of identical fermions with attractive interactions, within BCS theory, they will want to create this kind of superconductor, PX plus IPY. And, well, the reason for that came out of a calculation, which I discovered can be repeated, but not easy to explain in a few words. But typically people say these words. They say superconductor tries to maximize its gap. The bigger the gap, the better. This guy has bigger gap, at least if you don't have vortices. And that's why BCS superconductor tries to go into this phase. But the question which we faced is, well, you see, these guys, as you increase interaction strength, they become molecules, and who knows what happens with these molecules. Maybe they don't want to go into the PX plus IPY. So how can we find that out? And the reason we wanted to see what happens as you increase interaction strength is because when interaction is very weak, this guy is very fragile, easy to destroy. We wanted to create something which would be robust, but of course, on the other hand, we didn't want to go to very strong interactions. The chemical potential is negative, and as I explained, when chemical potential is negative, this thing doesn't happen. It only happens when chemical potential is positive. Actually, let me mark it here. So this is the only phase in which we can have non-abelian statistics. All others do not have non-abelian statistics. So we needed to see what happens in the BEC regime of these molecules, and it turns out that there is a calculation, a simple version of which would only take another couple of minutes, so I'll present it. So you see, once this molecule starts forming, they form a Bose-Einstein condensate. The condensate is described by the condensate wave function. In this case, delta mu is the condensate wave function. Now, when you have a condensate, it has a Ginzburg-Landau's theory, which describes how this condensate forms. In general, if the condensate wave function is psi, if Ginzburg-Landau's theory has the form t psi squared plus some a psi to the fourth power. So as t changes sign from positive to negative, at first, this guy is minimized by psi being zero, no condensate. When phi becomes negative, this guy is minimized by some constant psi. That means a condensate forms. So very similar situation happens here when we have this p-wave condensate, except now we have this delta mu. So the Ginzburg-Landau theory is controlled by, first of all, delta mu square. But second, the question is what comes out next? And, well, it's very easy to, if you think about it, so everything has to be rotationally invariant, there are two ways to write this term. One way is delta mu star delta mu square, and the other is delta mu square delta mu star square. So actually what it's describing, the reason delta has index mu is because these guys are spin one particles. Spin one particles are equivalent to a vector. This delta mu is that vector to which spin one particles are equivalent. So these are interaction terms. This guy describes interactions which are insensitive to spin. Particles come in with some spin and go out with the same spin. While these guys describe interactions where two bosons come in, the atomic bosons, and their spin gets combined in the spin zero. There's only two possibilities, actually, for two bosons to combine their spin. One of them is spin two, the other is spin zero. Spin one is prohibited by statistics if you want to be in the S-wave channel. So there are two interaction coefficients, N1 and A2. And now let's write delta mu as vector u, some real vector u plus I, some complex vector vector v. This u and v has nothing to do with u and v in the BCS theory I introduced before. It's just a way to write complex vector as a sum of two real vectors. But for some reason, notations which I'm using will be the same. So my question is, if v happens to be zero, then we are in this bad phase, this one. But if v is non-zero, we're in this phase. Well, let's plug it in here. It's very easy to see that the first interaction term here becomes u square plus v square square, and the second interaction term here becomes u square minus v square square. So in order to minimize its energy, such a superfluid wants to have u equals to v to minimize this guy. And u equals to v literally means that we're in this phase written here, that u is along x direction and v is along y direction. By the way, what I wrote here, you could ask me, what if they're parallel? This expression I wrote already assumed that u is perpendicular to v. So let me emphasize this. If I enforce that u is perpendicular to v, then I really need to nullify v in order to be px phase. So these kind of arguments show that if you take a gas of these atoms, and they're all identical, and they will actually want to go into px plus ipy superconductor. On the BEC phase, because Anderson said so, on the BCS phase. On the BEC phase, because this simple argument confirms it, and so it's quite likely that they'll do everything, the same thing in between. And actually, a more detailed calculation confirms it, the calculation we did about 3 years ago. And so we now believe that this gas will naturally want to be px plus ipy.
But this argument only applies in the negative mu regime.
Yes, this argument only applies in the BEC regime. Then, as I said, there's an argument by Anderson, which is more sophisticated, which works in the BCS, so somehow it should work everywhere. And actually, detailed calculation confirms this, that it works everywhere. Now, as always, there are, of course, some things which work against us. For example, there is some molecular physics which says that this T also depends on mu. And the one which corresponds to the bad component of delta mu wants to become superfluid before the other one. But it turns out that these arguments typically, or these problems can be avoided. We could come up with experimental setup where we believe this problem will not play a role. There are other problems. For example, there are questions on stability of this condensate. It's quite possible that at least with some atoms, if this condensate would be created, its lifetime would be short. And actually, there has been an experiment which was reported about a month ago, and was also reported at this March meeting, on trying to create such p-wave superfluid in an atomic setting. So they can create it, but its lifetime is about 1 millisecond, which is believed not to be enough to observe any of the physics.
In the BEC regime, on the BCS side, the lifetime is larger.
Yes. So I would say there is some hope, because we actually want BCS regime, where chemical potential is positive. But I have some guesses as to which physics controls this decay, and it could be the physics, which is also at work at the BCS regime. It could be detrimental to observing non-abelian statistics. But in any case, this is a situation which is clearly in progress, but there is some hope that maybe non-abelian statistics in cold atomic settings can be observed, and all of that with the help of the BCS theory. So let me stop here, and thank you for your attention.
What about creating vortices?
2002. Oh, you just rotate these guys, and vortices appear. Oh, there's already a bunch of papers describing this in detail, but the idea is that these guys can create essentially dips in the potential by using lasers. They can create any potential they want. So they can create a pinning potential, which they can slowly move, and the vortex will go around the other vortex. Well, this is all the question of time scales. So there is a gap in the system, which you try to maximize, and then you have to move slower than the gap. And, well, I don't know, but we can do estimates and see how slow that should be.
Okay, let's thank Dr. Gentile.